Welcome to episode 2 of the Big Car Podcast. This time we're looking at the infamous Rover SD1. Where the Austin Metro from the previous episode was British Leyland's fight for the small car market, the SD1 was to be their fight back for the luxury sector, which they'd owned in the 1960s with the Triumph 2000 and the Rover P6. Rather than making two cars, British Leyland threw all their weight behind the SD1, and it was so nearly a game changer. But I'm getting ahead of myself. On with the show. The Rover SD1 or 3500 was one of the coolest cars of my childhood. The design looked like it had fallen through a time portal from the 21st century. Sitting in one when it was launched, I imagined driving it down to Saint-Tropez to hobnob with all the coolest stars of the day like Cilla Black or Sacha Distel. Well, I was 8 and naive. I was wowed by the space-age dashboard that looked like it had come right off the set of Blake 7. And this car came out of old stodgy British Leyland, the company that had bought us the Morris Marina and Austin Allegro. So why did this amazing car do so badly? Let's find out. Rover had made its name in the 1960s, creating the amazing P6, but by 1969 it was clear they needed to work on a successor. Rover wasn't an independent company any longer. It had been subsumed into the British Leyland behemoth in 1966. That meant any decisions went through the main Leyland board. They saw the advantages of a new car. The Rover P6 and Triumph 2000 had sold in their droves in the prosperous 60s, selling to middle managers who couldn't afford a Jaguar but wanted something more upmarket. But Rover, Triumph, and indeed Jaguar were now part of British Leyland. So a competition was set up between the Rover and Triumph design teams to see which would create the new model. Triumph was first out the gate with its Puma design. This was the more dependable, safe design, an evolution from the Triumph 2000. Rover brought in their wunderkind, David Bache. He designed the Rover P5, P6, and had a hand in the crazy, brilliant upmarket SUV that was the Range Rover. Bache didn't want to play it safe. He wanted something ahead of its time, so took styling cues from the Ferrari 250M and 365 GTB/4. He decided the Rover driver of the future would want a hatchback for practicality, and he wanted them to have gullwing doors. In 1971, both teams met for the shootout. Triumph bought two large models, but Bache bought no less than 5 separate designs, plus the gullwing prototype. In the end, management plumped for the Rover, unfortunately without Bache's gullwing doors. It was renamed RT1, or Rover Triumph 1, to denote it was a joint development. However, in spring 1971, Rover and Triumph were moved into the specialist division, so the car was given the SD1 codename. Peter Wilkes was to be the technical director, but he retired in 1971 due to ill health, so Sven King, fresh off his amazing work on the Range Rover, came in to lead the engineering side of the project. Sven had worked on the gas turbine powered Jet 1, and him and David Bache were old friends from working on the P6. The project couldn't be in safer hands. But what engine should be used? The Rover 3.5-litre V8 was the first to be agreed. The all-aluminium engine had started life as the Buick 215, but owner General Motors had had reliability issues with it. They had sold the rights and tooling to Rover, who saw a light, large displacement engine as ideal for smaller British cars. The next engine to be used was the V6 from the Triumph 2500. However, there were issues making this a competitive engine for the 1970s, so it was agreed for the SD1s to launch initially with a V8 and get the V6 later down the line once Triumph had completed the redesign. David Bache refined the styling from the initial Austin Princess looking design through to what we know today. He wanted something that wouldn't look strange next to the supercars of the day, but would have all the practicality that is required by a growing family. Like a Porsche Panamera, but actually pretty. Once the exterior styling was finalized, the attention turned to the interior. Like the Range Rover, Bache decided on a pod design, putting the controls on top of a bench which could easily be swapped for left or right hand drive. Instead of wooden leather, space age soft plastics were used. This was to be a thoroughly modern car. An adjustable steering wheel, folding rear seats, removable rear parcel shelf, and internally adjustable mirrors were forward-thinking additions not yet common in 1976. Meanwhile, Spen was working on the chassis and engine. While the car looked cutting edge, the chassis was to be much more conventional. This was partly due to cost cutting at the suddenly cost-conscious British Leyland, but also to make the car simpler to produce and hence deliver a greater profit. In market analysis with members of the public, the SD1 blew the competition out of the water. When put up against the Audi 100, Rover P6 and Volvo 164, it was judged to be a much more expensive car than all of them, comparing it favourably to the premium Jaguar XJ6. Maybe given this, management were confident of high sales, so decided to build a new factory in Solihull dedicated solely to building this new car. On launch, the press loved it, lauding its styling and relaxed, luxurious feel, going on to win Car of the Year in 1977. The public clamoured for it, and with the Rover 3500 V8 priced the same as pedestrian four-cylinder cars like the Audi 100, Citroën CX and Volvo 144, it seemed a bargain. But British Leyland had underestimated demand, and soon long waiting lists formed with some changing hands for 25% above the sticker price. But this was the British car industry in the 1970s, so waiting lists just kept getting longer with strike after strike causing holdups in the new factory. When production did start, union agreed production targets meant a shortage of components. The adversarial nature of workers and management meant they weren't working together to satisfy demand and solve problems, so buyers were purchasing cars from the competition. It would take 2 years until production caught up with demand. When cars were being produced, there were problems with quality. The paint shop couldn't handle the imperfect bodies coming from the Castle Bromwich plant, resulting in too many imperfections in the finish. Lucas Electronics were pressured by British Leyland's management to cut corners on the electrics, and so electrical problems plagued the car, along with numerous other fit and finish issues. British Leyland was under pressure to turn a profit, and with the SD1 being such a hit, there was pressure to get cars out of the factory door even if there were quality issues. British Leyland had hired many new unskilled workers for the new Solihull factory, and they were making mistakes and slowing down the line. In 1978, 2 years after the SD1 launch, the production rate was still only half of what it should be. It wasn't to get any higher. In the middle of all this, the Rover 2300 and 2600 were launched, using the new improved Triumph V6 engine. Again, praise was heaped on these new models, especially the 2600 that seemed almost as good as the 3500 V8, but at a much better price. However, the engine had camshaft issues that only increased the quality woes of the new car. Then the hammer fell. Car and Autocar magazines both ran articles slamming the car for horrendous fit and finish issues that just shouldn't happen for a premium car from such a distinguished mark. In one vehicle, the door was so misaligned, daylight could be seen, and rain was seeping in. Residual values on used cars started to take a hit, and customers started taking notice. With little fanfare, British Leyland took the SD1 to the USA. The ex-Buick V8 was used, returning to its American roots, and the model sold was essentially the top-of-the-range V8S UK model. However, the same reliability problems haunted these vehicles, and the bad exchange rate made the car pricey. Despite all British Leyland's efforts, less than 1,300 were sold, and British Leyland beat a hasty retreat. By 1980, British Leyland had to cut production and had a stockpile of 10,000 cars waiting to be sold. They started discounting models by up to £2,000. By 1982, the strike-riddled new Solihull factory was closed completely and production moved to the smaller Cowley plant. They had intended to produce a total of 150,000 vehicles at Solihull, but only 98,000 were ever made. Rover added the luxury Vitesse model, a 3500 with an uprated 190 brake horsepower engine and all the luxury options. In 1982, the car received a small facelift, with 2-litre petrol and 2.4-litre diesel engines now available. Company cars at this time got tax breaks for 2-litre cars, so this helped sell fleet vehicles, but made for a car with little get-up and go. New premium Vanden Plas models offered the leather and wood so eschewed by David Bache in his 1976 soft plastic vision of the future. Although sales never took off, they did stay respectable until its replacement by the Rover 800 in 1986. Quality did improve, particularly when production moved to Cowley, but the damage was done. Once production ended, the plant got moved to India where the Standard 2000 was produced, but it never caught on and production ended in 1988. The SD1 is a story of an opportunity missed. In the 1960s, British Leyland had two hit cars on their hands, with the Rover P6 and the Triumph 2000. Instead of creating a common chassis and making two separate models as car manufacturers do today, they focus on just one model. What Sven King and David Bache came up with was possibly their crowning achievement, a car ahead of its time and something amazing. But management failed to successfully ramp up the new Solihull factory, and workers squandered the sales opportunities in the early days with industrial action that not only affected the number of cars in the showroom, but Rover's image with the public. By the time these issues were fixed, it was all too late, and the executive saloon market had been lost to the competition. But the SD1 is still the timeless shape David Bache hoped he'd created, and truly one of the most beautiful cars of the 20th century. It seems maddening that a large company such as British Leyland, with such history, could make a mess of putting a car together. If the SD1 had been manufactured to a decent level of quality — we were never going to get a great level of quality from British Leyland, but just a decent level of quality — the name Rover could be on the same level as that of BMW or Audi today. But in a way, it's still battling those cars. Rover also produced the Land Rover, which led to the Range Rover, and in an age where SUVs and crossovers are the car to have, all the luxury Range Rover versions today go up against the best from Germany. Now, before you write a comment, yes, I know I talk about the SD1 having a V6 engine when it was an inline six. That's something I've had many, many comments about when I originally made this as a YouTube video, and thank you for the comments. But if I edited just this one bit of audio for the podcast, then it would sound all wrong and it would take you out of the moment. So I thought I'd just leave it in and then put a comment at the end just to say, sorry, I know it's wrong. As always, if you like these podcasts, then tell your friends and even your enemies. If you want to see it along with many, many other car histories, then take a look at my YouTube channel. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode.